host Bob McChesney coming to you live today, this Sunday, August 10th in 2008 on WILL AM 580 based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest one of the most provocative and enlightening writers on the scene today, talking about his brand new book. Our guest will be none other than Thomas Frank, author of the noted What's the Matter of Kansas, talking about his brand new book just released, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule. So join us today for a full hour with Tom Frank. But first, before that, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Last week, the Federal Communications Commission voted to punish Comcast, the nation's largest cable company, for blocking users' access to the open Internet. Media watchdogs Free Press and Public Knowledge had filed a complaint with the agency against the cable giant for blocking legal peer-to-peer content to their users. In a landmark decision, Republican Chairman Kevin Martin and Democratic Commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein approved an enforcement order that would require Comcast to stop blocking and publicly disclose its methods for interfering with Internet traffic.
And would anyone here actually be okay if the post office was opening your mail and deciding that they didn't want to bother delivering it and hiding that fact by sending back to you stamped address unknown, return to send? And unfortunately, this is exactly the practice that Comcast was engaging in with their own subscribers' internet traffic.
That was Chairman Martin, who added that the agency had been very careful to hear from all sides, held two public hearings, and considered thousands of comments sent in by individuals and organizations. Comcast's actions were roundly criticized, Martin said, and not defended by a single other broadband provider.
If we aren't going to stop a company that is looking inside its subscribers' communications, reading the packets that they are sending, blocking the communication when it uses a particular application, regardless of whether there is any congestion on the network at the time, hiding what it is doing by making its consumers think that the problem is their own, and lying about it to the public, what would we stop?
Marvin Amore, General Counsel for Free Press, who wrote the complaint that sparked the FCC investigation, said that this is a bellwether case for the future of the Internet.
Millions of concerned Americans knocked on the doors of the FCC demanding that it preserve an open Internet, and the FCC listened. If this decision had happened behind closed doors in Washington, we'd have a closed Internet, not an open one. We have chosen openness to new ideas and choices controlled by all of us, and not closed markets controlled by phone and cable companies.
For more information about the Comcast decision, go to savetheinternet.com.
Far too often, those who are underrepresented by the media are also disconnected from its production and the policies that shape it. People's Production House, a media justice organization based in New York City, was founded to arm up-and-coming journalists with the skills they need to create media, as well as educate them on the policies that impact their work. Deepa Fernandez, co-director of the People's Production House, says that the group emerged to meet the needs of the community media sector that lacked a place to train people as journalists.
We got together and said, well, the only way to do this is to bring new folks in, and to bring folks whose voices are really not represented, and that is youth, that's community organizers who are struggling for community change. So People's Production House works in both in training new and emerging journalists, but also in educating around media policy issues so that we can really broaden the movement of those who are demanding policy change at a congressional level and also at the very local level.
People's Production House has several major projects that focus on radio production, community journalism training, and advocacy for universal Internet access to bridge the digital divide. People's Production House has taken their training philosophy to the Gulf Coast in response to the absence of media coverage of the devastation after Hurricane Katrina.
Media is really a tool that we talk to each other and we communicate to each other. So it's so important that folks in these devastated regions have ownership of media outlets.
People's Production House works with community organizers to ensure that they have a seat at the table when media policy issues are being discussed. They are working alongside national organizations like Common Cause and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights to educate the public about the digital television transition because they believe this moment presents an opportunity to expand community media.
We're much more concerned with seeing the public interest obligations on broadcasters increase as their broadcasting capacity increases. So, you know, we're pushing for more opportunities for folks like our own members who are part of community media on the new broadcasting channels.
To learn more about People's Production House, visit their website at peoplesproductionhouse.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL, AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. As part of my job, I get to read dozens of books every year for this program. Often, they're always interesting, usually very interesting and easy to read and fun to read. But there's one author, when his book comes along, goes immediately to the top of the pile, and that's our guest today. Tom Frank is the author of four very highly acclaimed books. I think most of you are familiar with What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God. His second book was one of the really outstanding works many years ago. And now he has a brand new book out, and I had the privilege of spending the last couple of days devouring it. And I hope those of you listening will have that privilege in the near future, too. And we're very privileged to have Tom Frank joining us today to talk about his new book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule. Tom?
Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
That's
you're out in the West Coast
kind
now.
Kind of you to say all that.
Well, it's true, Tom. I mean, you write brilliantly, as you know, and as you've been told, and the ideas are so stunning too. At the same time, it's a very unusual combination, and it makes for a book that is impossible to put down, frankly.
Well, that's really nice of you. It's a subject that's of, you know, immense importance to all of us. I think as we go into this election.
Yeah, and as I read this book, Tom, and I've had you on the air now, I think, to talk on my earlier show in Madison. I had you on to talk about your first book, and I've had you on about the other books a couple times each, I think, when they came out. And I'm always struck with your ability to really get your finger on the pulse of really something important that hasn't quite been dissected yet. And it seems like you've hit just the right moment to sort of do an appraisal of the last 25, 30 years and what it all amounts to.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, and as you've sort of captured what the process that I went through too. I moved to Washington a couple of years ago when I was finishing up What's the Matter with Kansas, and then all these scandals started breaking, and I was right there, in the middle of it, watching them all. First the Abramoff affair, which is still going on to this day, and then all these others, and they they haven't stopped. What's the latest thing? Ted Stevens, very senior conservative leader in the Senate, is going down, or looks like he's been indicted or whatever it is. Before that, the politicization of the Department of Justice, and it was like something out of the 19th century. And so I started getting out the old literature of scandal from that period, from not going all the way back to the 19th century, but the turn of the century up to the 1930s, the literature of corruption, that tried to theorize corruption, and what I found was that in a lot of ways the old stuff from the 19th century was repeating itself, not only encompassed these scandals like the Abramoff affair and everything else that's gone on in the last couple of years, but also just the sheer and amazing misgovernment, the way that conservatives have driven the state into the ground, made it impossible for the liberal state to accomplish the things that it was set up to do.
And I think, Tom, what you do in the book, and you're obviously not the first person to say a lot of this stuff, but I think you're the first person to weave it together in this manner, is that this isn't an accident. I mean, this isn't just sort of a fluke. There were a couple of bad apples. Corruption and incompetence is really at the center of the conservative project for governance.
Yeah. They're two sides of the same coin. The incompetence, I mean, neither one of them, you know, is they aren't proud of either one, and they probably don't want to get, you know, they're embarrassed when they get caught and stuff like that. And it's not, something that they all agree on, but it's an inevitable, these things are an inevitable consequence of thinking about government the way these people think about government. Can I tell you one of the funniest things that I found? One of the things that really opened my eyes while I was doing my research was this essay from 1928.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember it from the book.
Yeah, from the Coolidge administration, and it was an interview with the president of the Chamber of Commerce, which were, you know, big players then on the right and still are today. I mean, they're one of the heaviest hitters in D.C. And he said, "The best public servant is the worst one." And what he meant by that, you know, this shocking statement is that you don't want good people in government. You don't want talented people in government, because then government functions well. And if government functions well, then people will start to trust it and start to expect it to solve problems. And next thing you know, you know, the left is taking over and all that sort of stuff. And it's a slippery slope to some kind of disaster. And so, it turns out to not be just one lone crank saying this. This is a widespread conservative sentiment. They say things like this all the time. You don't want talented people in government. If anything, you want partisans and hacks and that sort of thing. But you, above all, you don't want government to its liberal functions. You don't want those to work well. Now, its conservative functions, that's fine.
You know, Tom, in the book, The Wrecking Crew, you spend a little bit at the beginning of the book contrasting that period and also the current period with that mid-century, the middle third of the 20th century, starting with the New Deal, extending into the Great Society, and really even into the early 1970s, through the 70s to some extent, in which there was a very different conception of government. And, you know, the book makes, I think, a pretty strong case the New Deal should be regarded, that era should be regarded as the exception to the rule more than the rule in American history. And also, one other point that really struck me as I read it was, having been a historian of the 1930s and 40s, was it made me appreciate again then, whatever one might think of Franklin Roosevelt, and he certainly had his flaws, his absolute horror at corruption, which was simply, now it makes a lot more sense to me than it did at the time.
Yeah. You know, you've put your finger on, well, on two really important things there. One is, this is a realization that I finally came around to, and it's a depressing one, but I think we have to face facts that the period of liberal rule in this country, when we were young, which we all thought was permanent, you know, we thought this was the natural state of affairs, and this would go on forever, where you had labor and business and government, this kind of tripartite arrangement, and you know, you had your social programs and you had your welfare state and and that was, you know, it had its problems. Yeah. It got us into the Vietnam War.
But inequality was decreasing, not increasing.
Exactly.
Standards of living were going up, not down.
That's right. And it was a middle class country. And it, you know, it's funny looking back on it now. It seems like it was pretty good. This is an idea that got into my head when I was talking to or having an exchange, I should say, with Mike Davis, where he said that he regarded the New Deal period lasting from the 30s up into the 70s as an exception, not the rule. You know, it wasn't, you know, we always thought, or people like me always thought, that the New Deal period and liberalism, that we had just advanced to a new plane of governance, and we had figured something out, and then we're just going to press on and keep on advancing and getting better at it. And but no, that period is over, and what we're left with is the sort of pre-New Deal style of government. You know, going back to like the Harding administration, or you know, the sort of kind of business government arrangements of the 19th century, and that's the classic American style, and that's what's come back.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Thomas Frank, author of the brand new book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, just published by Metropolitan Books. Is it officially out yet, Tom? I don't even know.
It is. It was published last week.
Last week.
Much to the horror of the civilized world.
And anyone who wants to call in with a question or comment for Tom Frank, the number here at WILL AM 580, 217-333-9455. 333-9455, or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And the book, it's hard to do justice to it in just an hour, because I could take any chapter and we could just go into many of the examples you provide. But in general, you give a pretty detailed chronology of the rise of the current far right to power, and then how it's exercised power once it's been there, in Washington in particular. And one guy's name comes up constantly. You've already referred to him, Abramoff.
Yeah.
And when I first heard about Abramoff, I confess I follow the news pretty closely. I just thought, okay, here's a sleazy lobbyist, and these guys, that's what they do. After reading this book, I realized he's really much more centrally involved in our political age than one might have imagined.
And yes, and you might also say he's much more conservative, and much farther to the right than you would have thought. Mm-hmm. Remember, he didn't testify when he was hauled up before Congress, and he's said very little since his scandal began. And so you would read in the papers, you know, Jack Abramoff is a Republican lobbyist, or Jack Abramoff is he's in with the conservative movement. But I didn't understand what that meant. That really didn't mean anything to me. I didn't understand it. And so I decided to do my own research, and I discovered that he really was, you know, and there were, if you go back to the early 1980s, which is when he sort of burst on the scene, he was a man of the very far right, and so were his colleagues, people like Grover Norquist and Ralph Reed. And they all came to, rose up through the system. And what's funny is that by the time, by now, they don't seem like they're so far to the right anymore. That's just how Washington works anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he had his hand in many, many, many episodes. For example, he had a very, very small role in the Iran-Contra affair, which is in some ways a sort of the beginning of all of the things that I talk about. He was big in this Reagan administration scheme of identifying right-wing guerrilla groups as freedom fighters. He spent a lot of time working on that particular fantasy. It's one that's really come back to bite us in the... am I allowed to say this on the air?
Yeah, well, you can imply it.
Okay. And he became kind of a shill for South Africa, the apartheid regime. And then disappeared for a while, and then reappeared in Washington as a lobbyist in the 1990s, and then the rest is history. Except for one other thing, some of the clients that he lobbied for are just astonishing. The one that really caught my imagination, I mean, in a horrible sort of way, caught my the nightmare. The place you have nightmares about is Saipan, this island out in the Pacific,
which you have a long chapter on in the book, is sort of the the nirvana or the of this sort of neoliberal conservatism.
Right, right. Well, they would say this. Abramoff would bring members of the conservative movement from D.C. He'd fly them out there to Saipan, and they would come back to America after having visited it and write about how it was Tom DeLay called it the petri dish of capitalism, and they talk about how it was perfect free market system. It was the sort of ideal that we all aspired to. And if you actually look at the place, look, let's take them at their word. Let's say that they aren't lying. They really thought this. If you actually examine the system out there, it's sweatshops, and massive exploitation. That's what the free market ultimately delivers to ordinary people is, a life of toil behind barbed wire, at the serving some people who just happen to be born in the right group.
Our guest today, Tom Frank, author of the brand new book, The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Tom, before we go to the phone lines, I want to ask you one quick question. You only refer to this briefly in the book, but it seems to be sort of gird the entire argument, which is the importance of the conservative movement and the right wing in power of having their sort of media system that sort of aggressively pushes the political agenda, the talking points of the day.
Yeah, and this is something that you don't, I mean, you and I think we know about it because of things like Fox News, but when you get to D.C., you find it's much more elaborate. D.C. is, on paper, the District of Columbia is probably the most liberal place in America. You know, it got your most liberal constituency, anyways. It voted for John Kerry by, I think, like 90% or something like that. But it also has this crazy feel when you go there of being very right-wing, because there's an elaborate and heavily subsidized right-wing media machine in the city. There's a daily newspaper that's so conservative it's almost nutty. It even has the news that it reports is completely different than what you'll see in any other newspaper in America. There's all these think tanks constantly holding events, publishing documents, filling up your email inbox with their announcements and their pronouncements about this and that, and it's a whole industry there, and they just fill the air, with their madness.
And one other point before we get to the phone lines, what was striking to me as I read this book, and I don't know if it was intentional or just the way it wrote itself, Tom, was that whereas in What's the Matter with Kansas, where you talked about how working class and poor people were supporting politicians and policies that were antithetical to their interests in religion and patriotism and family values and sexual preference issues weighed heavily in that sort of discussion. There's nowhere to be found in this book. I don't think there's any mention of Christianity or God or Jesus or gay rights or abortion. It's all about profit.
That's right. It's that stuff. You never hear about that stuff in D.C. except for as propaganda. It's they talk about it in a propaganda way, but that has nothing to do with the way they operate the state, with the way they control the state. It has nothing to do with it. It is about money.
Well, on that note, let's go to the phone lines for our first caller. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Hi. It's amazing that Washington Times is still owned by Sun Young Moon, as far as I can tell. So we have this fanatic from Korea who has some really bizarre ideas.
So you guessed what I was referring to there.
Well, the bankrolling them, yeah. It's amazing, and and I've got Tony Bankley, and it's a great journal. Human Events. I don't know if he's got any money in that too, but I got on their mailing list just to see what they're ranting about, and it is really amazing. My favorite Jack Abramoff connection, and you mentioned South Africa, but he actually went out to Hollywood to be a producer, and he helped produce a film called Red Scorpions.
Oh yes,
that was going to illustrate how evil communism was when it hit the African soil or something. I don't know.
That's right. It's about Jonas Savimbi,
who he ushered around D.C. a lot, apparently, when he was visiting. And Savimbi made the Contras in Central America look like Boy Scouts, because they actually did do cannibalism and all sorts of barbaric acts.
Oh, Savimbi was bad news.
I have an anecdote about the Kansas routine about people voting social values and instead of their economic values. I don't know if we want that. But you mentioned Gorver Norquist, too, and I'm struck by how I hear a lot of commentary on the pundit shows that say, well, people are more sympathetic to government regulation now, et cetera, et cetera. But I never hear this quote, obviously it's out in cyberspace, from Norquist, that he wanted to shrink government down to the size where it could be drowned in a bathtub. And then there's also the old thing about starve the beast.
Yeah.
The problem is that those guys hold all the paper, too, so if they really are really good at destabilizing government, maybe they'll have to take 50 cents on the dollar or something. But anyway, the rich folks are buying the T-bonds while they're overspending the budget. That's pretty classist. I argued with my father about abortion for the first time in a while, and he very ceremoniously sent some money to the McCain campaign. And when we got to talking about the economic aspects, he's fairly agreeable, but one of the problems, and you pointed out in Kansas, that the Democrats, he doesn't believe that they actually would do any economic populist thing. So, if that's true, he's got two corporate parties. He can vote his conscience and, be all hot about voting, sending money for life, basically. My grandfather was the same way. He was a charter member to the Progressive and canceled his subscription in the late 60s when they were coming out and talking about pro-choice. I don't want to do too much self-revelatory stuff here, but I'd like you to react to that, and particularly this, the way the media handles, the change in the climate, but they don't really investigate you know, the kind of ideologues that are behind some of these, you know, theories. You know, we hear a little bit about the Texas senator from Enron who shoots his mouth off, but, you know, did they really follow down what his theories were and how he profited from it?
Certainly not.
Thanks a lot.
I'll tell you why, and it's also this comes up when you write a book like this and you go out and face the media or the mainstream media, you know, the establishment media. They're terrified of the liberal bias critique. You know, this has been dumped on them for 30 years now, and to actually do that, what I've done in the book, which, you know, wasn't all that hard. Anybody could have done it, I suppose. To put these guys' ideology together with what they did, you know, Abramoff's ideology together with Abramoff's corruption. Or any of the other things that I talk about, the ideology of the Heritage Foundation together with what's happened with the Labor Department, for example, that is really not, it's not that hard to put these pieces together. Okay, it was hard. It was really hard. I worked really hard on this book, and I hope you all go out and buy it and read it. But somebody could have done it before me, and nobody did. And one of the reasons is that they're terrified of seeming, the media is terrified of seeming too liberal. And the same thing happens when I go on C-SPAN or on NPR or something like that. They desperately don't want to seem like they're doing me a favor. You know, I mean, even in this era when conservatism is collapsing around our ears, you know, every project they've tried has just been a disaster, and the public knows it. But the media cannot, they're so deathly afraid of being perceived as partisan that they just don't touch it. They just don't touch it.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. You only make a brief reference to it in the book, but again, I think that sort of follows naturally from your whole presentation of the conservative movement in the book as being, as you call it, bullies who play by a different set of rules and get away with it.
That's right, and it's also an industry. That's the other thing that I discovered after moving to Washington D.C. that conservatism isn't just a movement; it's an industry. It's something, you know, you sign up for it as a young man, you know, on the ground floor, and you work your way up. And this is what Abramoff did: you work your way up, and there's money to be made all along the way, whether it's, you know, what they were doing back in the 70s with direct mail, you know, which is a, you know, people could write entire books about that, where the fundraiser would make all sorts of money off of these conservative sort of fright gags, you know, and you work your way up from that to being sort of a hitman for big corporations, battling the left for money, to being a lobbyist, you know, to sort of managing the entire effort, orchestrating the whole media campaign, and becoming very rich. And at the top, you've got, you know, the sort of the contractors, the revolving door, the people who go back and forth from government. The, you know, these very conservative people who go back and forth from government into the private sector, where they get contracts out of their old friends. And at each step of the game is golden.
And you know, Tom, let me stop you there, because to do justice to your book, the heart of it, the meat of it, really you go through in several chapters this whole process of how conservatives govern, the subtitle, the book, they actually do. And you just referred to it there, but I really like you to go a little more into that, you know, what steps they actually have taken starting in the 80s, but really exponentially increased under George W. Bush's administration. And, you know, the first one you went through was personnel, what they do with personnel and the whole notion of public service and civil servants.
Yeah. And I sort of mentioned that briefly, that they have a deep distrust of public servants, of bureaucrats. And they say this all the time. You know, President Reagan used to always talk about this stuff, you know, how bad public servants were. And they, no surprise, they have, you know, done everything in their power to antagonize the civil service, take their bargaining rights away and, you know, fire them en masse and, you know, do all these sorts of things, call them terrible names. But the main thing that they want to do and that they have done is to shift the work out of the hands of the civil service and into the hands of private corporations, government contractors. And they call this contracting out or outsourcing or simply privatizing. And this has been their grand project since the 80s. They sort of came up with it in the 80s. But they really only got to run with it under the Bush administration, where they've just outsourced every imaginable kind of government work. And you now have it, you know, federal agencies. You'll have a federal, you know, publicly paid bureaucrat working side by side, doing the same work side by side with someone who answers to, you know, a corporation, who's employed by a corporation. Now, the guy working for the corporation is ordinarily paid many times more than the public servant. And he doesn't answer to, I mean, he's supposed to be accountable to you and me, but technically he is accountable to the shareholders, to his boss. And the accountability issue, you know, it sounds boring, but in fact it is the crux of the whole thing. We don't know how they've spent our money when they outsource all this work. We really don't know if things get done. I take that back. We do know. It's been a disaster. For all the superficial evidence, you know, these people have gone to Iraq. I haven't gone to Iraq myself, but to study the reconstruction there, and it's just been a disaster across the board. We've spent billions and billions and billions of dollars, all of it, you know, through private contractors, you know, or not all of it, but most of it through private contractors. That's who's rebuilding Iraq. You know, it's not the Army Corps of Engineers. You know, it's KBR or whoever it is. And they've done this unbelievably incompetent job.
And as you show in the book, Tom, I mean, there's really sort of a ecological cycle here where these companies bankroll the politicians who then, you know, have the lobbyists who bankroll the politicians, work with the politicians, and the politicians come to work for them when they get out of office. I mean, as you said, it's an industry.
Yeah, and that's one of the most disheartening things that you discover when you go to D.C. They call it the revolving door. And there's many examples. One of the ugliest has to do with the Medicare prescription drug benefit, which they wrote up. They mm-hmm. wrote into law a few years ago. It was an early achievement of the Bush administration, and the law was basically written by lobbyists for Big Pharma, who happened to be, you know, they came out of Big Pharma. By the way, Pharma is the name for the Pharmaceutical Industries Trade Association. They have a very beautiful building in Washington, D.C. So these guys come out of pharma and are working for whoever it is that's writing the bill. They write the bill. The bill gets passed. They immediately and you know the bill is the prescription drug benefit is like the biggest boondoggle of all time. I mean, it's basically a billion-dollar handout to the pharmaceutical industry.
It's just basically overpaying for a product that there's no reason to pay that much.
Yeah, they wrote into law that we would pay outrageous prices for something when there's really no need at all. Okay, then as soon as these people get this law, as soon as the law is passed, they quit their public jobs and go back to work for Big Pharma. The man who technically passed the law, who wrote the law, whose name was on the law, the congressman from Louisiana, it was notable because he immediately quit once the law was passed and went to work for Big Pharma. And got the biggest lobbying contract of all time. I think he gets $2.5 million a year.
The infamous Billy Tozen?
That's right. That's the guy, yeah.
Yeah, and well, you know, the other part of the discussion of the book I found, you know, disconcerting and not surprising, but when it was put all together as you did, it was disconcerting, was just how often and how routinely people were put into important positions who, one, were incompetent but were political loyalists to the conservative cause, and two, who in certain areas like environmental protection, labor rights, were entirely hostile to the mission of the agency.
Yes, that's right. You look at something like the Department of Labor, and in the book I go down the top management are at the Department of Labor, and I think almost every single one of them is in some way hostile to the labor movement, if not actually to, you know, workers themselves. And they conceived it as their job to sort of put that agency in reverse. They were going to go out, they're going to police labor unions, not make sure that, say, you know, there's safety in the workplace or something like that. No, they're going to go in the other direction. This has happened across the board. There's some of the most atrocious examples of this were in the 1980s when Reagan came in. This is why we can say that conservatives always do the same thing. They put these people who are hostile to the mission of the agency in charge of it. The most famous was James Watt, who they put in charge of the Department of the Interior. But the Department of the Interior has always been a sort of, they've always put in these kind of almost, you would say, sarcastic staffing decisions at the Department of the Interior. These people that are just, you know, incredibly, comically hostile to the idea of conservation. Now I'm stopping now.
Okay. Very good, Tom.
My problem, Bob, is I just blab.
Well, that's not a problem at all. Our guest, Tom Frank, author of the brand new book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule. He's our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM580. The phone number, if you'd like to call in with a question for Tom Frank to talk about the new book, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yes, hello. I have a comment and a question. I talk about this with my friends, and that is when the parasites kill the host. And by that I mean the aristocracy, the leaders, conspire to take over government and do poor people out of all their money, which we're seeing now. And we've seen it happen throughout history in the French Revolution. They guillotined the aristocracy. The Bolsheviks in Russia shot the aristocracy. On up through China and Cambodia, the killing fields. And I'm just curious, how close do you think we are to that kind of revolution? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. You sort of talk about where we're going after this. I don't recall this being on your list of options, though.
No, that never really occurred to me. I that doesn't seem like where we're going at all. I think where we're going is a sort of slightly nicer version of the 19th century of the total laissez-faire state. I think it is very possible that we'll have that Obama will win, the Democrats will get a big majority in Congress. People are really, really disgusted with conservative rule. But you got to remember two things. First of all, the conservatives have gone to great lengths to lock in their idea for the state and to make it impossible to change. And this is something that I go into in some detail in the book, the sort of idea of permanence. And they talk about this all the time, that we want our changes to the state to be permanent. We don't want them to be reversible. You know, we know that the Democrats will get back in someday. Of course, you know, that's what happens in a two-party system. They'll get back in, but we want it so that they can't reverse what we've done. And they say things like this all the time. And in fact, they've taken steps to ensure that this is so. And just two things I'll mention real quick. One is the outsourcing and the privatizing that we talked about. And the revolving door. I mean, the government has lost so many of its best and brightest people. You know, it's in their very, very obvious interest to go take a job with a contractor when they're paying three times as much for doing the same work. I mean, it's
when their job is so demoralized if they stay in government.
That's right. And when your boss, you know, the president or the chairman of the head of your department or whatever is constantly talking about how awful public servants are. There's no reason why you would stay in such a job. I mean, yeah, it has good job security, but, you know, when they're paying three times as much for the same work, you know, why on earth would you do it? So you've got that's happened to the government, and it's going to take a huge effort to rebuild it. People that I would interview would use the term thematized, meaning that agencies had become like FEMA, and FEMA is, of course, sort of the model, the poster boy for a government agency that doesn't work. You know, and we saw what a bad job it did in New Orleans. I mean, it's utterly catastrophic. And this was an agency that just a few short years before had been doing fine. But that's one huge impediment to it, you know, to fixing the problem. The other is deficits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't have a problem with deficit spending in theory. I think it's obviously a tool that the government has to use. I mean, that's what Keynesian economics is all about. You know, you use deficits to do all sorts of things. But that's when you use, you know, when you're doing it, you know, in good faith and with a bit of intelligence. What happened was conservatives got in and said, "Oh, we're allowed to have deficits. Okay, then watch me," and just ran that sucker into the ground. First with Reagan, and then with Bush. And the reason that they do that is because it defunds liberal programs. You know, it causes a crisis, right? They spend the money on, well, first they spend it on tax breaks for their favorite constituents, and second they spend it on, you know, contracting out, sending the money off to Iraq where it goes to KBR or something like that, you know.
Well,
they blow the money.
Yeah, if I can interject, Tom, having read the book, it seems you do good discussion of how Clinton sort of comes in with his hands tied with this enormous debt and then spends eight years cleaning it up and balancing the budget, but not able to really do much in terms of social spending because
he's
sort of cleaning up the mess. And then as soon as Bush comes in, he says, okay, now it's my turn to make a huge mess again.
That's right. Exactly. And the readers will, or I'm sorry, your listeners will remember. I hope they become readers, Bob.
Yeah, I hope so too, Tom. I think they will.
But they'll remember when Clinton got elected, he used to talk pretty big about, you know, all the things he was going to do. He's going to have national health care. He's going to have big public works program, you know, all this stuff. And just before he was sworn in, his economic advisors sat him down and said, you know, hey, Bill, you're not going to be able to do any of that because of this enormous deficit that you are inheriting from Reagan and Bush 1. It's, you know, all of that stuff is off the table. You're going to have to spend your entire presidency cleaning it up, you know. And the reason we know about it is because Clinton threw one of his famous temper tantrums and used some really choice expletives. And, I mean, it's a pretty funny episode, actually. I mean, it's a horrible episode. But after seeing that happen, and this was well publicized, it's in like a Bob Woodward book or something. After this happened, you know, a conservative would almost have to do the same thing again because they know now that running up deficits like that defunds the left, makes it impossible for liberals to get in and do their kind of great society stuff. So, of course, they do. And it's not a surprise that now at the end of Bush's term we're finding out that the dude has ran the deficit up much higher than anyone knew.
Our guest is Tom Frank. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines where we have some callers patiently waiting. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yeah, sort of a two-part question, history and prophecy. Why has the liberal wing never been able to create such an industry as you described, and what are the possibilities it could create one of its own in the near future?
I can barely hear the caller.
I'll repeat it for you, Tom.
Okay.
And the second caller?
What can they do to recreate one of their own?
Okay, great. Thank you very much, caller. Yeah, the question, Tom, is why can't liberals do the same thing conservatives done and build up not just a movement but this sort of industry? Why haven't they done it, and can they do it?
Well, the conservatives think that liberals did do it. In fact, they often refer to liberalism as the model for all the stuff that they do. They think that's what the Great Society was. It was handouts to favorite interest groups and big city machines, and then these groups would turn around and deliver the vote. And they thought that's what it was. And you know, there's a certain point to that. You know, it's accurate to a certain degree. But I think if you're entirely cynical about politics, it's possible to see things like, you know, the Tennessee Valley Administration. It's just a giant pork barrel scheme designed to buy votes from these poor people in Appalachia or something like that. I can see how you could think that. But at the same time, the things that liberals did were also designed to achieve a certain amount of social democracy, and they did do that. and there was a lot of, you know, dedication to good government in the liberal years. But they perceive liberalism as having been a machine just as corrupt as themselves. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why they don't feel bad about what they've done. They just say, well, you guys did it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you make a strong case of that in the book. You know, John McCain is one of the big points he's running on in his campaign is his opposition to earmarks and to getting the money out of government. And you write about earmarks quite a bit in the book. So is McCain sort of a new age Republican? Is he going in a different direction?
You know, I kind of liked McCain. Earmarks have their place, I should say. I should take a step back. Earmarks have their place, but so does oversight. I mean, the whole idea of earmarks is that a congressman can or a senator can send money to a certain project independent of review by some expert somewhere. And that's suspicious to me. That's suspicious to me to begin with. But I could see how it should have its place. I mean, after all, they are democratically elected. But there should also be a lot of scrutiny of it. There should be oversight. They should be held accountable. All that sort of stuff. And you know, there are a lot of things about John McCain that I used to like. That was one of them. He was, after all, he's the man who busted Jack Abramoff. You know, you got to give him that. He also was always good on campaign finance reform, which is important to me. And what am I forgetting? Oh, on contractor issues, he's one of the maybe three or four guys in the United States Senate who really understands the problems, or seem to understand the problems with contracting out of government. By the way, one of the other people who is really good on that issue is Obama. But all of that's just disappeared since he started running for president. It's like the man had some kind of, surgery where they removed his personality and and replaced it with someone else. I don't get it. I don't understand what's happened to him.
And as I read your book, and I recall how Obama's running sort of a nonpartisan, postpartisan campaign, and I'm thinking, can you win a nonpartisan, postpartisan campaign if the other side is throwing mud balls and hand grenades at you and you're up there lobbing flowers and wiffle balls at them?
Yeah, the answer is no, you can't. I mean, the only reason he's doing that is because for so long he was so far ahead of McCain that he's able to, to take the high road and be above the battle and seem very noble and all that. And that's got to stop. And I think he'll understand that. I think that's going to be obvious to him very soon when McCain catches up to him. Which, I mean, look, that always happens in a presidential race. I've written about that. By the way, did I tell you I do a Wall Street Journal column?
I meant
now?
To mention it. I read it.
It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, Tom Frank is now. How frequent is your column, Tom?
Once a week.
Once a week, Tom Frank. What day are you?
I run on Wednesdays. And that's what I'm writing about for this Wednesday. Is that Obama has to start getting He has to roll up his sleeves and get into action here, but I've written about it a couple times already. That's what needs to happen. This sort of postpartisan stuff is strictly for the birds.
That's like a pre-loser approach, I guess. our guest today,
Dukakis did this, if I remember right.
That's right. Our guest today is Tom Frank, author of the brand new book, The Wrecking Crew, How Conservatives Rule, just came out last week. Also, as we just were reminded, a weekly columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Farina, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Tom Frank.
Hi. This is really interesting. I saw you on Democracy Now! Last week and was really impressed with your, laying the... Laying the corporate fascism at the feet of the modern conservatives, or what they call conservatives. It's just a personal observation. They're running the government in an anti-American way. I mean, in a fundamentally anti-American way. Anyway, I've got an idea for a constitutional amendment that this is something I came up with. How about a change on limiting the term of the Supreme Court justices, maybe 10 years, maybe 8 years or something. But this is one of the problems. These these extremist right-wing people are locked into the Supreme Court, you know, for the rest of their lives. And one of the things I would, one of the first things I would put before them, I mean, a reformed court would be to revoke the corporate personhood rights of corporations, and to be able to hold them accountable. If they're going to privatize everything, the corporations that, you know, that are doing these major government services should be absolutely accountable on maybe even a year-to-year review. I mean, a truly, you know, fair system.
Yeah.
The next thing that I think could be a real solution would be the Amory Lovins approach with the hypercar, where you actually have a vehicle that not only powers your house, it's you refuel it from your house with solar power turned to hydrogen. You power your house with it, and then during the day you power your business with your car that you that's your transportation. To decentralize that way, and in a really logical way, the way Amory Lovins puts it, I think it's a way to crack the system as it's being stacked against the public. And one other thing is, it just blows my mind that McCain is advocating 50 to 100 new nuclear power plants in the country. It's the most, and according to Lovins just recently, he was on Charlie Rose of all places, it's the absolutely most boondoggle way to produce energy bar none. It's absolutely astronomically more expensive than any other energy system you could possibly dream up of, not only the long-term danger.
Thank you very much, caller. Let's let Tom take over at this point.
I'm really not up to speed on a lot of the environmental things. My friend Tom Gagin, you know, when he talks about the he's a labor lawyer in Chicago, when he talks about the nuclear power plants, you know, he makes this sort of the same point that I do in the book. In France, they run on nuclear power. I think it supplies half of their electricity or something like that, and they never have any problems. And one of the reasons for that is that the French, you know, the best and the brightest in France go into government, and that's who's running their system there. It is that, you know, they take it absolutely dead seriously, and they don't screw it up.
You know, Tom, one other thing that the caller referred to was the justices of the Supreme Court, and that seems – you don't talk much about it in the book, the court appointments, but it seems to be a crucial part of the strategy of making it impossible for a liberal state to – or a New Deal
to
ever
return. Sure, that's the easiest way to lock it in is the Supreme Court.
And what's striking to me also is how, you know, the Republicans and Democrats play by such different rules when it comes to picking these judges. The Democrats always – pick these 58-year-old seasoned people who have like terminal cancer, and the Republicans pick these 25-year-old graduates of Liberty whose parents were campaign contributors. I mean, who are going to live till they're 128?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's fascinating, and I'll tell you one of the sort of sad, awful predictions that I made in What's the Matter with Kansas has come to pass, which is, you know, they got their Supreme Court justices in, and no, they haven't gone after Roe v. Wade. I mean, they might someday, but these guys are team players, and they know to overturn that is to really, you know, to hand the Democrats, you know, the election for the next 10 years or something. What they have done instead is just hand out favors to business.
Yeah.
And if you get in a couple more of them, what you're going to see, they actually have a scheme, and I'm not making this up, and I'm not exaggerating it. It is taken seriously in conservative circles. They have a scheme to basically declare all social welfare programs, everything since the New Deal, unconstitutional on grounds that it constitutes, you know, illegal takings.
Yeah, you refer to that briefly in the book,
yeah,
as I recall.
Yeah, this is widely, this is a big hobby horse on the right wing. They talk about it and write about it all the time. You know, the caller made another point that I'd like to talk about, mm-hmm. which is holding contractors accountable. And one of the, you know, I mentioned earlier how much of our government is now contracted out, outsourced, privatized. One of the really fascinating things about all that is, you know, we honestly don't know what they're doing, and there's, you know, there's various agencies throughout the government scattered around in the different departments and whatnot that are supposed to be holding contractors accountable. And one of the conservative sort of one of the innovations that you rarely read about outside of Washington is that they've tried to shut these agencies down, the agencies designed to hold the contractors accountable. One of them, the funniest one, one of them, they actually tried to outsource the agency that was supposed to oversee outsourcing. They're gonna privatize that sucker. And it's so the result is we really don't know how the money's been spent. It's kind of funny to go back and look at the beginnings of privatizing and outsourcing. They did it because they said it would save us money. That was the whole idea. And instead, it's to as far as we know, it's been fantastically expensive and, you know, extravagantly wasteful.
Let's take one final caller today for Tom Frank, our guest, Tom Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew. Let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air.
Any of the quote-unquote mainstream media shown any awareness of the statements that you make? I agree with them, and I would include an incredible arrogance along with the other mix of bad characteristics.
Tom?
Any of the mainstream media?
Are they aware of your criticism and the logic of your statements?
Sure. The book is getting reviewed, here and there. And look, I'm on a speaking tour. I'm doing my best to get the word out there. Look, there's a huge problem that I sort of referred to earlier, and Bob, you know what I'm talking about here. The mainstream media is totally hamstrung by the specter of liberalism. It scares the hell out of them to, you know, have somebody talking about these things from a left-wing point of view, which is what I do, to give that view any kind of credence. They're terrified of that.
Well, they have to balance you with Ann Coulter or something. And so
yeah,
Ann Coulter
exactly.
Just pulls stuff out of, you know, the air at best.
And so while there is – look, all my sources in the book, or most of them anyway, are the mainstream media, or else they're the very right-wing media, which I use for, you know, other purposes. But book are like, you know, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, that sort of thing. But But no, they don't dare to together. It does not happen.
Now, Tom, we've only got about 30 seconds left or so, or 45 seconds. If you could hand this book to Barack Obama and, say, every U.S. Democratic senator, and they said, well, why should I read this book? What would you say if you only had, like, got them in the elevator and only had, like, 15 or 20 seconds? What would you say to them?
I'd say, look at what they've done to us. And figure out how we're going to fix it.
Okay.
Look at what they've done to us.
And how have the reviews of the book been so far?
Oh, Bob, come on now. Don't ask me that.
Okay. Well,
you know they hate me.
They do?
You know they hate me.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Tom, I have good news for you.
That's my dumb little cross to bear. I came into this world and you know, back in the Baffler days, I used to dish out the spite, and by God, I can take it.
You certainly can, and you're not hated everywhere, Tom Frank. That's for darn sure. I hear the band tuning up in the background, Tom, which means they want to kick me out of the studio.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Tom Frank, author of The Wrecking Crew: How Conservatives Rule, for joining us today.
Bob, it's absolutely my pleasure.
And good luck with the book. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back a week from today with Dave Zirin talking about sports and media in the Olympics. Until then, everyone, have a great week. I want to thank Andrew O'Boyle, my producer, Kyle Mabry, for working the boards. See you all next week, folks. Bye-bye.